Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. In this episode, Professor Jeremy Black talks to Graeme Stewart about the role of Prussia in the 18th century and whether its ruler, Frederick, was really so great.
The 18th century in the old-fashioned history books was referred to in the case of Germany as the rise of Prussia. And that was a narrative that took us from, as it were, the great elector who had become ruler of Prussia in 1640. It took us on through his son, his grandson, his great-grandson, Frederick II, Frederick the Great, who was ruler from 1740 to 1786. And it looked at the 18th century essentially in the line of Frederick's life and achievements, but also the perspective of the degree to which the Second German Reich, the one organized in 1871, was to be founded by Prussia. So in other words, it was a Prussian interpretation, a Prussian rationale, a Prussian teleology for German history. And you will still find a lot of people that take that viewpoint. I think it's worth saying that I'm going to, in the next few minutes, to look at that a bit critically. I mean, obviously, one tries to be wise in this respect. It is the case that by the end of the 18th century, Prussia was the strongest of the Protestant North German principalities, and one would be naive if one ignored that situation, whereas in the beginning of the 17th century it had been Saxony. And part of our story, if one is looking at North Germany, is looking at not so much the fall of Austria, the bigger picture on the bigger scale, but on the more North German scale, one's looking at the failure of Saxony to match Prussian strength. But it's also the case that if you alter your start line and your end line, you can often produce a different chronology and a different account which needs explaining. So in the case of Prussia, of course, one has its terrible defeat by Napoleon in 1806-1807, most famously summarized as the Battle of Jena in 1806, but there were in fact a whole series of clashes and loss of position. And the extent to which much of Prussia in the 1807 peace agreement was, as it were, taken over by France, that about 40% of Prussia was lost territorially, and Prussia, in the size of its army, was restricted, rather as happened to Vichy France at the behest of Germany in 1940. And there are always echoes and parallels and contrasts that are worth thinking about. I always find it interesting that those people who comment on the harshness of reparations after World War I, failing to note the extent to which the Germans had imposed reparations on France after the Franco-Prussian War, or for that matter, France had had to pay reparations after the Napoleonic War. But anyway, going back to Prussia, our end point can give us a very different interpretation. It can suggest that with Prussia, you have the rise and then decline of a militarized state, and in fact, a state that is only liberated, if you wish to use those terms, and subsequently there was to be talk of the German War of Liberation in 1813, as a result of Russian success. Rather, as I suppose the counterpoint would be that France was only liberated in 1944, as a result of Anglo-American and Canadian intervention, beginning with D-Day, and obviously the French played a role, but it wasn't as large a role as they were subsequently to reimagine. So one can make that sort of point, and then that starts us thinking about Prussia in a slightly different role. The Prussian royal family, which very much prided itself on military victory, some of which were consequential and major, some of which, such as the great elector's famous victory at Fehrbellen over the Swedes in 1675, were quite frankly large-scale skirmishes, that the Prussians in this respect emerge as no different from many other, as it were, rulers on horseback in the 18th century, similarly validating themselves through military victory, and with the last of the great rulers on horseback in that practice being, of course, Napoleon. And therefore, from that point of view, you could argue that rather than seeing the development of a strong state, a strong public culture, etc., etc., what you actually had is an ephemeral achievement, which is ultimately dependent upon military success, and that military success proves very parlous indeed. Whereas Frederick the Great did well in his first two Silesian Wars, 1740 to 42, 1744 to 1745. His third Silesian War, what we would possibly better know as the Seven Years' War, 1756 to 63, was not a brilliant triumph, and grinding battles in which he was either successful only in a limited way, let's say the Battle of Prague, or the Battle of Zorndorf, or battles in which he was actually unsuccessful, like Grosskunersdorf, showed the weakness of the Prussian military, showed the fallibility of Prussian military technique, its famed tactical innovation, the attack in the oblique order. The Austrians proved able to counter. The Austrians ended up with, you know, better artillery than the Prussians, and the Prussians found in their campaigns in the North Bohemian hills a lot of limited success, and that was to be repeated in Frederick the Great's last war, the War of the Bavarian Succession, 1778 to 1779, when he invades Bohemia, and far from reprising his success in earlier conflicts, he actually does badly. And there is nothing to, as it were, anticipate the Prussian invasion of Bohemia during the Austro-Prussian War of 1866. So we can start to see the possibility of presenting a less impressive account of 18th century Prussia, obviously in comparative terms, far less impressive than the Russian state created by Peter the Great, but also actually in terms of Austria, the Austrians who in the early 1680s had barely hung on against the Turks besieging Vienna in 1683 and putting, whilst at the same time the Austrians were under pressure in the western borderlands of the empire by an expansionist France, there was a very different picture of an Austria which by the late 1720s is making other German powers anxious, a position that is to be reprised once Austria is allied with Russia and able to put pressure on Prussia, as in the Seven Years' War, but is also to be repeated in the anxieties surrounding the schemes of Joseph II, the Emperor Joseph II, in the 1780s. So one can argue that far from, in great power terms, far from seeing Prussia with the perspective of a hindsight as a power that clearly was setting the agenda, that this appears to be very questionable. It would have seemed very questionable to Prussians encountering, for example, brief Russian occupations of Berlin in 1760, or Germans as a whole encountering Russian armies moving west into Germany in 1716, 1735, 1748, during the Seven Years' War, and then again in 1813, one might have a slightly different account of how, where one thinks this great power context is. And as far as Prussia itself is concerned in policy issues, a lot that is to be ascribed to Prussian policy in kind of a building up of the economy, encouraging skilled immigrants, a measure of protectionism to build up local industry, etc., etc. Well, this is pretty much bread and butter stuff for 18th century government. It's in the tradition of what is known in the jargon as Cameralism, which is a kind of economic philosophy and practice of the protectionist type. I suppose the French equivalent we would call is Colbertism. And there is no way that Prussia is unique. Instead, if anything, the only difference about Prussia is rather like President Putin today seizing Ukraine's grain. The Prussians prove very good at despoiling others of their resources in order to benefit their own economy.
Well, Professor Black, I'm very interested in the wide point you make there about choosing your framework of years to see the perspective of Prussia's rise and so on. But I wonder if we can just start right at the beginning of the 18th century when the Brandenburg really becomes, you know, the king in Prussia. Was there something about Brandenburg and that part of German land which made its rise as Prussia likely, the resources, the nature of statecraft or the nature of the state that the Hohenzollerns had developed by the end of the 17th century? So if we move the framework back into those last years of the 1600s, that we begin to see as the roots of what became the Prussian military successes in the early part of the 18th century?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I mean, you know, a lot of emphasis is placed on the achievements of the great elector who I mentioned. I'm not sure that I would necessarily put him out of context of other rulers of the period. And on top of that, what I would say is there is a degree of competition between the North German ruling houses, the Guelphs in Hanover, the Hohenzollerns in Brandenburg, the Wettins in Saxony. And of those, you could argue that it's the Saxons who gain the throne of Poland from 1697 and the Hanoverians who gain the throne of Britain from 1714. And incidentally, members of the House of Holstein-Gottorp end up briefly establishing themselves in the Russian inheritance. You could argue that they were the more successful ones. I mean, you know, the famous phrase that was used about Brandenburg Prussia, that it was the sandbox of Europe, the reference to its soil being poor and therefore its agricultural productivity being poor, I think was a major problem. It meant that the classic account that many of the landholding gentry, the so-called Junkers, found military service the way to achieve any degree of rationale, wealth, self-worth, I think is true. And certainly, whilst one would be mistaken to argue that the Prussian economy stood still, there is no equivalent to the agricultural development seen in either England or Holland. And in terms of industry, the major industrial sections that Prussia is to rule by 1830 all come to it by conquest. Silesia, great source of linen production, other industry as well, but great source of linen production, of course, comes to it by conquest from 1740, and the Ruhr comes to it as a result of the territorial reconfiguration at the end of the Napoleonic Wars. So the actual industrial and economic base, I think, of Brandenburg Prussia is really quite weak. And that helps to account, in my view, for the degree of envy that Hohenzollern figures show towards Saxony, and the almost zeal with which they bombard Dresden, the Saxon capital, in 1760, just as they're to bombard Paris in 1871 and to bomb London in 1940. This kind of almost vandalistic zeal of people that know that they are actually second raters who are jealous of societies that are more cultured and more impressive.
We talked in a previous podcast some months ago about the so-called military revolution, which you unpicked to a large extent. And I'm wondering what there is to say on that theme about, you know, the chicken and egg of the centralized state of Prussia and its militarism. Did one follow the other, or are we actually mistaken to draw too strong a link between the two? And was Prussia actually, and we're talking the early 18th century, much more centralized than other major German states?
That's very interesting. Well, first of all, I wouldn't say it was more centralized. The position, the authority of the ruler varied greatly by his territories. It always was a he, by his territories. And that pattern remains the case. So when Frederick the Great takes over Ostfries, East Friesland, in 1744, he has less power and authority there than, for example, he has in Brandenburg. In Brandenburg, he has less than he has in East Prussia. In the Rhineland territories of Clave and Xanthan and Wesel, he has less authority than he does further east. So there's, I think, I wouldn't say it is centralized. I mean, in some respects, the most centralized state in Europe is the one where, as it were, power and authority is least monopolized by the crown, and that is Britain. I mean, in Britain, you don't have internal tariff boundaries after the unification of the 1707 unification of Scotland and England. You have Parliament legislating for an entire area. You don't have regional assemblies of a pattern of the regional estates in places like France, within France, and within the large dominions of German rulers. So in some respects, and you could take that a stage further if you want, and say, if you wanted to play with ideas, and I'm a great one for playing with ideas, you could say that it is the centralized nature of the British state and its ability to raise revenue in a trusted fashion with parliamentary accountability that underwrites the strongest European military, which is the Royal Navy. I mean, the Royal Navy has a military capability and ability to deliver verdicts that's far greater than anything than, say, the Prussian army can do. And, you know, it's interesting. People are apt to praise Frederick the Great as a general. Well, I mean, come on. He only operates across a sphere of several hundred miles. He only operates in symmetrical conflict against similarly armed neighboring states. He never has to run a counterinsurgency war. He never has to run a transoceanic war. He never has to run a transoceanic war against either non-Western peoples and states or against Western states. He never has to run a naval war. I mean, you know, he's actually quite limited. Now, you might say, you know, he didn't have the opportunities, and that's absolutely fair. But if you compare somebody like a Frederick the Great with, shall we say, a Wellington, who operated in both India and Europe, that's a much greater responsibility on him and much greater a need for focusing on different tasks. So no, I mean, I think that there is a very limited, I mean, I've written about this very extensively, this business about the war makes the state and the state makes war. I mean, Charles Tilly dreamt that up. It sounds good, but you've actually got to be quite careful about this. As I argued in my book, War in European History, actually war tended to unmake the state. And if you think of Germany, I mean, in the case of Prussia, pretty abundantly clear with the damage left after the Seven Years' War, even more in 1807, and even more in 1918, and even more in 1945. So you could argue that war unmakes the state rather than the opposite way around. I mean, what Tilly was doing and was, which is so often the case of historians, and particularly the historians that get cited. I mean, nobody's going to bother to cite me because I introduce complexity and nuance. Nobody wants complexity or nuance. What they may want is some easy aphorism, some glib theory like the early modern European military revolution, which apparently explains the peg, provides the clear context, and they can then get on with their detailed work on the dairy industry in Mecklenburg-Strelitz or whatever they want to work on. But the reality is, well, these days it would probably be identity among cows that wanted to transition. But the reality is that the relationship between war and statecraft is very complex. And it doesn't necessarily mean if you have a powerful army, as Frederick the Great's father did, Frederick William I. I mean, Frederick William I is a bit of a bully. He's willing to threaten. I mean, he has a military confrontation with Hanover in 1729, with Holland in the Netherlands in 1732. He threatens war over the Jülich-Berg crisis in 1738. Does he actually fight? No. He briefly gets involved in the Great Northern War, and very briefly, in order to take part of Swedish or Western Pomerania. Other than that, he stays out of the wars. He stays out of the War of the Polish Succession, for example, even though it directly abuts his territory. So I would say what's interesting is that in many respects, Frederick the Great was a fool. What he did was, instead of using his army as a aspect of great power diplomacy without risking fighting and without risking the uncertainties that could come from it, he repeatedly rolls the dice for war, and bluntly, he puts Prussia under enormous devastation, and he's bloody lucky in the Seven Years' War that the Russians change policy when Tsarina Elizabeth dies and is succeeded in 1762 by the pro-Prussian Peter III, Catherine the Great's erstwhile husband. I'm not convinced that Prussia in the 18th century was a great power, or indeed necessarily had the makings of a great power. I think that's a reading back into the 18th century by 19th centuries, people focused on the 19th century and people, commentators living in the 19th century, who are seeking an acceptable, in their eyes, backstory.
Well, I'm very interested in how you compare Frederick the Great's, as it were, overuse of his military power with that of his predecessor, having a very limited application of it. I was thinking back to that earlier period, the first years of the 18th century, and how significant the Great Northern War was to the augmentation of Prussia, by which I mean Sweden's pushback from the Baltics. Should we see that as a defining event in Prussia becoming a more significant and cohesive state?
I wouldn't go that far, because if you look at the major gains made in the Great Northern War at the expense of Sweden were by Russia. Estonia, Ingria, that's the area around St. Petersburg, and Livonia, which is essentially eastern Latvia. That was far more substantial than the territorial changes in Germany, where the principal changes were Bremen and Verden, which were not acquired by Prussia. They were competed for by Denmark and George I of Hanover. And George I of Hanover, using British resources to Hanoverian ends, and people like Ragnald Hatton were sort of ignored that completely, but they were wrong. Using British resources to Hanoverian ends, managed to acquire that for Hanover. So, if anything, the Great Northern War was to the benefit of Hanover rather than to the benefit of Prussia in terms of territorial gain. What I would say is that Prussia remains in the shadow of Russia. It is an enormous shock when Peter the Great defeats the Swedes, takes a lot of the Swedish Empire, intervenes in Poland and drives out Augustus II. Intervenes in Poland and imposes intervenes in Poland and imposes his candidate as King of Poland, and then moves west into the empire. That's an enormous shock for the Prussians. And you could argue, if you want to, that the Prussians who were sensible were aware of that issue thereafter. And you could argue that there is this tension within Prussian policymaking as to how far Prussia should seek a kind of friendly relationship with Russia, albeit as a sort of client, and how far, conversely, they should play a major role in creating anti-Russian coalitions, as they do in, shall we say, 1720, and even more in 1791. And of course, there are Prussian forces in Napoleon's invasion of Russia in 1812. And I think there is that tension there. And I think what one could argue is that Prussia loses out, because again, part of Frederick the Great's stupidity, and it is stupidity, is he drives together the two powers that he is most fearful of, Austria and Russia. And that creates the crisis for him. Now, that was an extraordinary folly, because these other powers had competition in other spheres. They compete essentially in the Balkans. They have a measure of competition in Poland. But Frederick the Great had the capacity to do that. Now, one of the interesting things is that because there is a long tradition of praising Prussia among British historians, there has been, and particularly Frederick and the German Enlightenment, the Aufklärung, there has been a failure to look at the multiple deficiencies of that system. And I'm afraid to say, I think that's true of, I don't think there is a single good biography really on Frederick the Great, certainly nothing to compare with Rolls' Wilhelm II, which of course is available in English. And I think there are a couple of problems that help to explain this. One, you need to be good at military history, by which I mean not like Fraser's book on Frederick the Great's armies, which is completely strategically naive and has no real comparative basis. But also, in order to write effectively on Frederick as a statesman and Frederick as a figure ruling internally, you need to be able to look in a comparatively mature fashion at elsewhere. And it's not really done very well. I once wrote a book review about a study of 18th century Europe. And I said, all too much of it was a ménage à trois of Prussia, Austria, and Russia, without really looking elsewhere to consider how other rulers operated. And I think that's true of a lot of Germanists. They lack the broader picture, unfortunately.
Mm. Well, one of the broad themes of this period is the tension between Prussia and Austria. One never likes to use the word inevitable when talking about history, but what was that tension comprehensible for reasons of just the importance of those two states as poles within the Holy Roman Empire of the German lands, and so there's an almost inevitable conflict between Vienna and Berlin. Or are there other reasons? Are there cultural reasons? Are there religious reasons? Are there historic reasons why this tension should have predominated through the 18th century?
Well, that's very interesting. Certainly, religion is an important factor, and people who underplay the role of religion in 18th century international relations are foolish. There is a sense of a strong Protestantism, pietist Protestantism, opposed to Counter-Reformation Catholicism. But in terms of your question about two different poles of Germany, I'm not sure I would go that far. I would say that if you're looking at the 1700s, 1710s, 1720s, 30s, and 40s, Austria's principal opponent in the Reich is actually Bavaria. And indeed, of course, Karl Albert becomes the Emperor Charles VII, the only non-Habsburg to be emperor in this period. And there are periods of Prussian-Austrian cooperation. So, you know, 1725, the Frederick William I signs up and joins in the alliance of Hanover against the Austrians. The following year, he swaps over and joins the Austro-Russian alliance, in part because he's terrified of the Russians. And there are periods under, particularly Frederick William I, and to a degree under his father, Frederick I, in which a sense of German identity, of Germanitas, particularly opposed to the expansion of French power. After all, Frederick William I, as a young man, had fought in the War of the Spanish Succession against the French, as indeed had his brother-in-law, you know, the Hanoverian, the future. They were fighting against the French, and they were allied to the Austrians. So at that stage, I think it's fair to say, and just as, you know, German rulers in the 1680s and 1690s, including the future George I, including the Margrave of Baden, including the Elector of Saxony, all led forces to help the Austrians fighting the Turks in what we would now call, well, what they then called Hungary in the 1680s and 1690s. So I'm not sure I would see an inevitability. I think that was part of the problem that you get with Frederick the Great, that Frederick the Great helped to commit Prussia to an anti-Austrian policy, which was a major incubus for Prussia for a very long time. And you could argue a major weakener of Germany vis-a-vis both, on the one hand, France, and on the other hand, Russia. So to stand it on its head, in the opposite to the Second Reich idea of Frederick the Great as a great German patriot, you could say the exact opposite, that Frederick the Great was a selfish, greedy man. Many other rulers have been like that, Napoleon classically, but he was a selfish, greedy man who weakened Germany greatly. And I think there is that to, you know, to think about. You could set that as an essay for your students, Graham. You know, it certainly provides you with a different way of looking at Frederick to the conventional one. And there's no point, what I try and do in my books is to offer new ideas. I think that's very important for scholars to do that, not in some sort of some perverse implausibility, but to try and draw out wider implications and wider contexts. And I do think there is too much of a tendency to praise Frederick the Great among particularly literature by British scholars. I think in the case of Germany, there is, as you know, the so-called Third Germany tradition, the first Germany being Austria, the second Germany being Prussia. And the idea, which was particularly strong during the early decades of West Germany with its capital at Bonn, when, of course, East Berlin was the capital of a hostile Germany. There was this interest in a third Germany of sort of the idea of the empire being the first empire here, having a measure of consensualism, having a measure of perforce governments that only had so much power because they were constrained in part by both local estates or parliamentary systems, but more particularly by imperial institutions that had jurisdictional power. And there were, you know, and rulers who were seen as abusive, such as in Württemberg, could be displaced, or efforts could be made to displace them. And that kind of approach was one which possibly now is being maybe going to change now that Germany has been, depending upon your point of view, been reunited or united. You have to be very careful what language you use there, because of course you've got to think of the use of language by Hitler during the Anschluss of 1938. I'm not suggesting that modern Germany is like the Third Reich. All I'm pointing out is you need to use language carefully. But certainly, you know, if you were reading German works published, dealing with international relations, published by people like Aretin or Mediger, you had a sense of, and this is several decades back, you had a sense of Germany is not being defined in terms of this polarity of Austria and Prussia. And instead, the idea is that that polarity, when combined with France and French intervention, helped to doom a fundamentally benign system.
Well, I'd like to end by asking a little bit more about the role of France and also Britain in the conflicts within Germany, within the German lands in the 18th century. Do you see a coherence in London and Paris's interventions and alliances and conflicts, or is it opportunistic? Is there a conscious divide and rule policy at work, or should we take each conflict entirely on its own terms and the circumstances which gave birth to it?
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, as far as Britain is concerned, I think from 1714 onwards, one has to take note of the Hanoverian commitment, particularly under G1 and G2. G3 was interested in Hanover, but that's been over-egged by a number of scholars. There was nowhere near the emphasis placed on it by G2 and G1, and there was a conscious sense of difference, both by him and by others. But if you go to G1 and G2, they personally wanted both territorial expansion for Hanover, but also a degree of stabilization of the empire. And they were, in a sense, operating in a situation in which within continental Europe, Britain was also a second-rank power. I've already referred to Prussia in that light. Well, so was Hanover. And there were the big powers were France, Austria, and Russia. And how best to respond to them was an issue. So, for example, in the 1720s, the Hanoverians felt that the Emperor Charles VI, the Austrian ruler, was increasing imperial jurisdiction, pressing hard on the liberties of German states, particularly German Protestant states, and therefore the Hanoverians looked to align with other Protestant states, including Prussia, against this. Whereas, for example, in the 1740s, the British tried to align with Austria against what they saw as an expansionist France. So a lot depends upon a multifaceted international system. And those studies of international relations, which are bilateral, Franco-Spanish or Austro-Prussian, by their nature are very flawed because people at the time who are conducting foreign affairs and thinking about it don't think in bilateral terms, they think in multilateral terms. Now, as far as the French are concerned, as you probably know, in 1756, in what's known as the Diplomatic Revolution, France and Austria, which had had poor relations over the previous quarter millennium, moved closer together. And they actually allied together in the Seven Years' War. And of course, one of the eventual products of this was the marriage of Louis XVI with Marie Antoinette. But I think it's worth bearing in mind that there have been scholars, German scholars, who have looked at precursors. They've looked, for example, at a brief attempt at the end of the reign of Louis XIV, at better Franco-Austrian relations in 1715. I myself have written in 1728 how Chancellor Sinzendorf in Austria wanted better relations with France. So there were precursors, but You were asking a straight question, so I'll give you a straight answer. On the whole, there is, until that period, a use by France of German politics in order to construct alliances against Austria. And from that point of view, the Wittelsbachs, so those are the rulers of Bavaria and the Palatinate, and also usually by election, the Archbishop electors of Cologne, the Hohenzollerns of Brandenburg, and the Wettins, and the Hanoverians could all be deployed by the French in order to try and create alliances against Austria. This builds on how France had gone into the 30 Years' War in 1635. It builds on both precursors to that, French support to anti-Habsburg German leagues, for example, at the end of the reign of Henry IV, and it could also be traced through the late 17th and early 18th century. So France, A, did not see any limit to its or to its expanding power. And remember, this is a period in which France expands eastwards, takes over territories that had previously been parts of the empire, most obviously Alsace, and then in 1766, Lorraine, but also plays power politics in Germany in order to weaken the opposition to it.
Well, Professor Jeremy Black, in the next episode, we will be looking at whether there's anything specifically German about the Enlightenment and the effect and consequences of the French Revolution in Napoleonic Wars in the German lands. But for talking us through the 18th century, Jeremy Black, whose A Brief History of Germany is out now in paperback, thank you very much indeed.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.